Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to a very special edition of the El Arpa podcast. Now, regular listeners will be familiar with me and Mary, normally having our chats about culture. But today, we have a treat in store for you, because we sat down with Juan Garcia Herreros, whose tribal name, well, from his great nation, is Snow Owl. We sat down with El Amir and the conductor and composer Gavin Greenaway. Now, Mary, these men, not only are they linked by their talent and their eloquence when talking about music, but also linked by another fact. What is it?
That they're all part of the World of Hans Zimmer Orchestra.
And they played in Barcelona recently. And last night they played in the Wisnik Center in Madrid. And we sat down with them in their hotel for around an hour and a half. Had a great chat before the podcast, during it, and afterwards as well. Very personable people. And just a real pleasure. We spoke about culture, musical styles, musical refugees. Mary, what were your takeaways from the interview?
I was just amazed at how articulate they were. I mean, not just with the music. Fair enough, being musicians, being able to express themselves, but they were actually very capable of putting all those feelings in a very eloquent way.
Yes, Noah Owl mentions in the interview about being a musical journalist and also that conversation that happens in music through the decades. We touched on that. Gavin Greenaway and I had a nice chat about the changing face or the changing sounds of movie soundtracks and how the movie industry has changed and how we've moved away from a communal experience of experiencing music. And I really enjoyed listening to his thoughts on that. Well, you sat down with El Amir and discussed flamenco and how it's both Spanish but international, and maybe the tension between those two things as well, and also the links between the Arabic language and how he plays his music and his guitars, I guess, no? So if you're interested in all of that, and well, stay tuned. We're not going to keep you very long in part one, so the interviews are next, and I do recommend that you stay around, because it was, again, a true pleasure to talk to wonderful human beings, fantastic artists, and just all-around special people. But before we do that, we should mention as well that Snow Owl and El Amir have collaborated on a new single called The Horde, and of course Gavin Greenaway has released his new album Woven, which for us is a musical landmark and a true pleasure to listen to as well.
From the mic.
Oh yeah,
it's unbelievable. You're gonna have to do a hum canceling.
These are special NASA.
Yeah, it's a NASA mic. Look at that.
Snow Owl, thank you very much for being with us. This is our El Arpa interview with three fantastic musicians from the Hans Zimmer band. We have El Amir, Gavin Greenaway, and Snow Owl here as well. So just before we started recording, you said that you are a podcast junkie. You're an aficionado of podcasts. Where did the obsession begin with this art form, with this way of listening to things?
The obsession for podcasts, well, first of all, thank you for taking the time for coming here to see all of us.
No problem.
It's wonderful to be a part of your podcast as well. Really appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
The fascination with podcasts for me began with, let's say, the most primitive form of podcast, which was just story radio in Colombia.
Ah, okay.
You know, I basically grew up with that, listening to all these folklore stories with my grandmother. Always on the weekends, we would put on the radio and she would cook and I would hear all these stories. And I missed that format. And fortunately, the technology has allowed for more storytelling to happen, you know, on the podcast side. And I'm just completely addicted to it. I just, it feeds the mind, and it's the only format left which is really making the mind create an image of a situation instead of just feeding it in front of your face, you know, all the time with a picture.
Whoa, very beautiful answer. Mm. And do you feel as well that podcasts could be considered maybe democratic, because anybody can pick up a microphone and upload a podcast to the internet? No,
there's extremely powerful podcasts which have changed elections, which have influenced policy, which have maybe changed people's lives by sharing the true stories of other people. So I think this is the one format left, really, for democracy, for storytelling, and I mean the use of it is endless.
Okay, it's very interesting that you mentioned that, because the man who invented it really foresaw the podcast being this vehicle for expression and changing society in a very profound way as well. So and it's good to see that it's fulfilling that kind of need for it as well. And of course, we mentioned your stage name, Snow Owl. Mm-hmm. And here's where you're going to hear my bad Spanish accent. So your name is Juan Garcia Herreros. You mentioned previously that Snow Owl, you are attracted to the owl because it's an animal that can see and peer into the darkness. And I guess the association is that music can save people. It can bring light to the darkness, for example. And I get that impression from seeing different things that you've been involved in. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little more on that and kind of explain how that process could work, how music can lift people out of the darkness?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, Snow Owl is my indigenous name.
Okay.
So when I was born, as Pedro told me to say, I shouldn't say tribe, I should say nation, which is very beautiful. I'm from the Arhuaco Waju Nation.
Oh, we're going to ask you about that as well.
Yeah, let's go about that. So, in itself, the symbolism of the owl about bringing wisdom or bringing people out of the darkness, this is a very powerful image. And I've managed to always bring that into the music that I do with that purpose. Actually, there's not a piece of music that I don't write where I'm trying not to help somebody to come out of something. Every piece that I write has a story.
Okay.
And I'm always trying to imagine how can this particular song help somebody in this situation. And so it's a very, very human. I'm always considering human conflict and finding a way how I can help people to come out of that, you know, through the music. And the music is one of the greatest ways to help people to maybe to find closure,
okay,
in situations, or to inspire them to triumph over adversity. There's multiple. What a great gift we have, human expression. Endless human expression, and a true artist is expressing the sound of his time. That way, the people which are living with me now, just like the people that were living then with Mozart, they knew that was the sound of the time. They could relate to it, and they felt it. So we have to be true to the sound of our time and document it, because later on, another musician or another person will be listening back to that to maybe continue the torch.
Okay. That's very beautiful, because I mentioned to you before we started recording about Blind Boy, and he talked about music as being a conversation from one generation to the next, and each time there's a new musical piece, it continues that conversation, stretching from, as you said, Mozart maybe to to a modern group. And you mentioned your nation, and in fact, in the BBC today, they talk about your tribe, or your nation, sorry, who have come out of isolation to try and save the world from climate change.
Yes.
And there's a lot of beautiful things there, because you also mentioned in other interviews about having a need for a cultural, yes, a desperate need for cultural unity.
Yes.
And that seems to be reflected in what I've read in that article as well. So is this something that you feel has been completely given to you by your nation, or is it something that you feel that also is part of you personally? Or
I mean, literally, the chief of the Arawako said to me once, Snowal, the Christians and the Muslims have a very good press secretary. And he said, would you mind sharing stories or some of our beliefs? And I love how he put it. He said, sharing. He didn't say force people.
Yeah.
He didn't say make them believe what we believe. None of that. He just said, just let the people know that we're here. And that was a great honor to receive that assignment. And that was the day I started to wear then the traditional war paint and or the masks that we have in our tribe.
And I saw an interview as well where you mentioned where you're wearing the paint on your face, and sometimes you're not allowed to speak when you have that.
That's terrible. Walking on stage, usually we have the organizers, they make an announcement to warn the people that I can't speak because of certain masks. Like the blue mask means the face of the universe.
Oh.
And I'm not allowed to speak because the universe will give you a message directly.
Okay.
To all the people who are looking at you. And it's amazing how many people, after concerts, when we would go to meet and greet or CD signings, there was multiple men and women that would just look at me and then they would start weeping.
I've seen that, yeah.
That was very impacting. And I still have to compose myself not to break as well, because it was very emotional to see them weep.
Well,
but I have to maintain composure. So,
and what provokes that, do you think? Is it the silence, which we're not used to maybe in a culture, or people are aware of the significance of what you're representing? Or
it's a reflection.
Yeah,
it's a reflection. It's ancient knowledge.
Okay.
It's something that a person might look at this and might think maybe just question, is everything that I know or have ever lived real? And that's kind of what the feeling I get, that their entire concept of what is reality is challenged.
Okay. And in your nation, do you think that happens as well? Because from my limited knowledge of what I've read and everything, there seems to be a sense of keeping... there's a thing with where you put a stick and you, that's like, sorry, I was saying this very badly, but you know what I'm referring to.
Absolutely.
Where you keep, it's a thought of every man, every person, and it's like that stays in every generation. And
yes, but it's a tree in the end, you see.
Yeah.
We how deep do the roots go of any tree? And the tree, you know, the original internet are the roots of the trees on earth.
Okay.
And if you tap into that, you know, you'll have all the secret ancient knowledge, you know. So that's the answer to that.
I know, it's fantastic. And also as well, for example, because when we talk to Elamir as well soon, you both have said, I think, independently in different interviews that you feel you were like born into music. And you both have said that the first sounds that you heard or the rhythm of your mother, for example.
Absolutely.
I'm just interested, just as a, you know, as creative people, as artists, how much do you feel that you are, for example, a conduit of kind of inspiration, and how active an agent do you feel in the process of creating something, if that makes sense?
I'm fascinated with silence. Inside of the silence is the music.
Okay.
Somehow, all of us here are blessed to hear silence. Or in other words, our strongest ally when we create any kind of music is the silence. It's the pacing. It's the moment where you actually let the resonance reverberate through the silence. And I don't know if everybody is meant to make music, but the only thing that I do know is if there's one thing we're meant to do on on this physical life, it's to listen, to listen. And when you listen, you exist.
Okay.
If our cells in our bodies, if our molecules in our body are resonating and vibrating at such a speed that it makes this physical form, then technically all we are is just listening.
Vibrations. It seems to be also a form of mindfulness as well.
Absolutely.
Which is, you know, people are rediscovering as well. And you mentioned silence, and also I want to ask you about natural sounds, because in one of your songs, which we have here, Balada Paramis,
yes.
See, there's the accent again. you've inserted the sound of a Syrian waterfall into the song, which is absolutely amazing as well. For you, what is the fusion between natural sounds and music as we traditionally interpret it? What's the relationship between those two things?
When I went to this Styrian waterfall and I recorded it with microphones and I put it in with the orchestra, with the Vienna Philharmonic people, and at first it was just an experiment, because it was exactly as I predicted. Everybody thought something was wrong with the CD. Everybody said, "Ah, there's noise in your CD. What is that noise in the background? What is that?" And all that. And then you even though we clearly wrote this is a waterfall in the background, people didn't get it. And I don't want people to forget the sound, the natural sound of flowing water. And there's another reason why I did that. In the frequency spectrum, especially in the digital frequency spectrum that we live in today, there's a thing called pink noise or white noise. And this is what engineers are using to test the spectrum of a PA system, or how frequencies are responding in a room. And it's every frequency that is possible is inside of this pink noise. But if you compare it to water, it's exactly the same sound. So technically, everything that is possible is in water.
Okay, that's right, yeah.
So, and then I thought, how much percentage of water is inside of our bodies?
Okay, that's very nice.
So there we're back to the whole silence and reverberation and vibration and all.
It's a very beautiful perspective, and also because it's Syrian. Now, in our previous podcasts, we've gone to exhibitions in the Casa Arabe, for example, about Syrian refugees. It's it's a topic that we're very interested in. And I feel when you go to the exhibitions, you see the humanity of the people, which can get lost very easily in the newspaper headlines. Do you think by even having something simple like a waterfall in a song, you kind of show the humanity of the country, because people... It sounds stupid, but they realize, oh, well, they have waterfalls too. They have things that we have. And they become more than just a headline or statistics, for example. Do you think that people could respond to that in that way also? Or
That's applicable to every country. Every country has their unique nature landscapes, but also their own unique instruments.
Yeah.
And why were all of these instruments created? It was... At the end, it was just a simple thing of somebody saw a lightning bolt strike and they wanted to communicate with the sky. They wanted to recreate that sound, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but in today's headlines, we see more of the... We seem to get more of the, I guess, the provocative clickbait type of...
Yeah.
of headlines, which have become... Even standard, it's depressing to see how it's basically one press release, and everybody copies it, copy and pastes it in all formats, in all languages, and that is completely misrepresenting what is really happening at the daily life level of all these people around the world, especially in these war-torn countries, because there are so many stories of the human spirit enduring.
Yeah.
And I wish that we would focus on more of those stories. And the only place where I find that, I have to say it again, is in podcasts.
Because all of you are like polyglots. You know, you have different styles, different influences, different instruments.
Yes.
And when it comes to telling stories, journalistic stories, I think you're very right. It's very lazy and very cut and paste. And there are so many ways you can tell a story, either of a current affairs event evolving minute by minute, or maybe with a retrospective of something that happened quite recently. But at the moment, it would seem that journalists aren't really doing their job. But musicians, especially people like you, seem to be stepping into that void and telling these interesting stories and in different ways and stretching the ways of telling stories.
I see my role as a musical journalist.
Yeah, okay.
That's how I view it.
Wow, okay, that's an interesting way of putting it, and I really like that. So before we wrap up with you, Snow Owl, is there any other questions? Oh yes, before we finish, for example, colours as well. You've explained this before in other interviews. Were you influenced by, for example, I don't know, this could be a reach, but the Three Colours trilogy in French cinema, are you familiar with that?
Oh, I met the director recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I met him in Poland. That's fantastic. He was at the Krakow concert, you know?
Yeah.
The spirit paths have always had colours, and the blue road being the spiritual, the red, the warrior, the yellow, the balance, and the one we don't speak of is white because it's enlightenment. But we're not allowed to speak of that, of course.
It's too sacred.
It's too sacred, and one cannot claim that you've reached this enlightenment. So I rarely mention that out of respect for that. But there is something about colors, which I guess I should mention. For example, this yin yang symbol.
Yeah.
Of this black and white, and we've become such a, you know, divided, and we're in society, and people seem to forget that, yes, okay, you can't see in the darkness, I understand that, but also too much light is also blinding.
Okay.
And this is something that people shouldn't forget either, that both extremes of the, you know, people considering that light is healing and surrounding themselves with it and all of these things, and in reality they're blinding themselves to some form of false righteousness.
Wow, that's a so it's Noel, thank you so much for your interview. You've given some really amazing answers. It's been a real pleasure, and your bandmates have a lot to live up to. The next part.
I'm passing the mic now. Passing the mic.
Thanks so much.
Who's next?
Okay, well, Lelamir, thank you so much for speaking to us. It's a real pleasure, especially as a Spaniard. And the first thing I wanted to ask you was, because what really strikes me is that flamenco is exported as, you know, the one of the main things about Spanish culture. So if you go anywhere, the first thing that they tell you when you say you're Spanish is like, oh, flamenco. But then when you're actually in Spain, a lot of people are very ignorant of what flamenco is. So why do you think that is the case, and how do you think that could be fixed?
Yeah, flamenco is basically the music and the culture and the way of expression of the province of Andalusia. So that is all already marginalized, right? So it's not the whole nation that expresses itself through that traditional music. That's one point. The second point is that people formerly who have interpreted that music were very humble people from little villages, farmers, blacksmiths, gypsies, people who were like social outcasts somehow, you know, and they would express their feelings and their daily habits through that music and through the lyrics and the way of singing. So that is also marginalizing people from society. And I think within that, there is this powerful energy that is attached to that music. And because of its ages and centuries of influences of so many cultures that have passed through Spain, and especially in Andalusia.
So actually, it's not what I was mentioning about that idea of the community and, you know, people kind of like how important you think that is for flamenco, because I feel that there is a bit of a dichotomy between, for example, in your albums where it's just you playing the guitar, and also live performances, or, you know, in some of your videos where there are normally people clapping or singing and it's very spontaneous. So how do you you know, make bridge that gap between the music in the album and live music, or that interaction?
Initially, flamenco, as you mentioned rightly, is a collective thing, people getting together and performing that together. And once you establish a professional aspect to it, of course you have like maybe only a solo singer accompanied by a guitarist, or the urge of an artistic guitarist who's composing and he plays by himself. So I really would make a difference between what is an album in flamenco and what is the life character of that music. You would pretend maybe two different things. And an album is more artistic, and the live performance is as well artistic, but it has a different delivery, different emotional delivery. And these people, you know, flamenco people and the flamenco culture has always been very savage in the positive way, just like expressing things without no filter, and really like basic emotions, love, hate, hard life, hard work, and all these things. And I think that makes the music have these enormous dynamics. You can go from a really harsh strumming to a very delicate arpeggio or melody line. And that is what the audience always feels as very intense, because they're exposed to a lot of strong emotions in a very short period of time.
Do you think in any way can be compared to jazz? Because perhaps other people are more used to that type of music internationally, and I feel that there's also that dichotomy between, you know, live sessions which are meant to be naturally spontaneous and, you know, improvising and all that, but then in the album obviously you need to stick to the scores. Perhaps Gabi also has some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think whenever you're performing live, there is the musician, and the musician is a person, is a human being, and that human being is driven by emotions, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, after that, the mind rationalizes and analyzes and puts things in place. Mm-hmm. But our basic engine of any animal on this planet is the emotion and the impulse and our intuition, and that is the life thing. Then once we go into the studio, it happens to me, I would play maybe a line two or three times because I say, well, I could make it better, but that's my mind was triggering me. Maybe if you listen again, you say, well, the first take or second take was better than the fourth, and then you'll realize that you always have to go with the flow and trust your inner impulse and your intentions and your feelings, because the feeling is truth, emotion is truth.
Okay, so that actually leads me to another question that I wanted to ask you, that is, when you are performing, well, every track has a different feeling for you, or what do you think of when you're performing? Because sometimes I feel that when you're focused on something that you know very much, very well, your mind can just start drifting and you start thinking of other things. But obviously in your case, because you're focused on your instrument, I don't know if every time you perform that same song you feel the same thing, or depending on your mood, one day it makes you feel sad and another day makes you feel happy. I don't know.
First of all, I think it's very important to make every day the same decision of trying to be in that present moment, because our mind can go miles away, you know, into outer space while you're playing in front of people. They think you're there, but you can go off, you know? And it sounds critical, but every day you have to make a decision of saying, no, I stay here, and now this part, as precisely as you can play it, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that you will play perfectly, but as precisely as you manage. And in this particular show we're doing right now, I think, because you mentioned, like, what do you feel, and do you feel the same things in the same songs? And every night, it hits someone else of the band who starts crying in a different section of the song, you know. And maybe there's one night that I really love Lion King and I'm like so emotional, And the next night, I'm emotional in a different moment of the repertoire, and I just skip through a song easily, emotionally. And it's really interesting to see how, even if you know the songs, and now we almost know it by heart, there's always things happening that you never can control. But we're getting there where we become the music, and then it affects you in a certain way that you really can't control it. But you have to, as Gavin said once, as a conductor, you can't let yourself take away by the feelings, because you have to control all these 85 people and their emotions and their ways of delivering it. So as a musician on the spot, you have to kind of control that too, because sometimes even with you playing, you can achieve somebody to cry, but without you feeling that sadness. But you can create that through music, and that is the magic of it.
Well, that's okay. That's definitely enlightening. But it's I think it's interesting for us that the same thing that happens to people as listeners happen to the musicians, because obviously, I don't know, sometimes when you listen to music, one day you think something is fantastic and you hadn't even noticed it at all some other day, or it was just there in the background. So, okay, that's very interesting. And one thing I'm very curious about is that, okay, with your Arabic background, I know a little bit of Arabic. I've studied for a few years, but it's very limited. But one thing that struck me when I was listening to your music is that pretty much with the guitar is a continuous, no? You're like continuously playing, and it's like a melody that you know, doesn't stop. It just sort of develops, and I think that's shown in some of your songs, where it sort of like evolves and changes, and suddenly, you know, it's very calm and suddenly gets really strong, and you sort of, it's kind of like an emotional roller coaster. And well, it just reminded me to, you know, when you're reading Arabic texts, then okay, you know where to put the full stop, but the full stop is not there. So do you see any parallels with that? Because I don't know, I think one thing is what's actually there in the music and for people to listen and to read, and another thing is where, you know, you have to stop. So do you see any relation between those two things?
I think you hit a very right spot in my case, because I grew up listening, my father would listen a lot to classical music, classical Arabic music, and flamenco. So I was exposed mainly to that kind of musical melody line. And I started to play the Arabic oud and the flamenco guitar almost at the same time. So these two languages have been together for many years. And even without me knowing what was going on in Andalusia and all these centuries, because I first started listening to the music, I didn't know the history. So later I found out about all these fusions, you know, and exchanges. And I see them both as there's a brotherhood, musical and cultural and emotional brotherhood in the melody line and the way they sing, or the rhythms, the scales they use. In Arabic music, it's very interesting, because you always think there will be an end at some point, but then it takes you right away to a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
They have that, you know, it always gets to some point and then they surprise you and they go somewhere else, you know. And in flamenco music, it's very similar. You have this development of a melody line, and you think, oh, they're gonna like resolve it, and they take you away, because also the rhythm is very important in those music styles, the patterns that will mark certain changes as well, you know. Amalgam rhythms, they're never straight, and like that never end in the same place, so it's always very tricky. And maybe that's why the melodies always surprise you as well. And then music actually is a reflection of a geographical place, you know. People think in a certain way, you know, when they talk, you know, when you go to Sicily, they have the hands in your face all the time, you know. And it's just how it is, and you don't, and that's like something already like to distract you while they're talking to you, because the street life is like that, you know. They do these things in front of you, so you get distracted, so you don't listen what they say. They can do things. And if you go to Northern Africa, it's so vivid, you know. Then you go to Norway, and they're so calm, you know, and the music is different. So music is a reflection of the people and the geographical environment they live in as well.
So do you ever get to play with other people from Spain, from the south of Spain, before you could speak the language, or were you always able to speak Spanish? I was just interested because of what you say, that it's possible for you to understand each other without actually, you know, through the language of music. So I was wondering if you ever experimented that experienced that.
Yeah. I grew up with three languages, which was Germany, because I was born there. Mm-hmm. My grandfather is from Germany, but then my mother comes from Colombia,
mm-hmm.
and my father's from the Middle East. So I've been speaking German, Arabic, and Spanish since I was a little boy. So I already, when I was listening to flamenco music, I could relate to the lyrics,
mm-hmm.
and that gave me a lot of information about how these people express themselves, right? And then I felt like I'm one of them because I absorbed it. And I knew many of the patterns, the rhythmical, harmonical patterns, before even playing the guitar up, because I've been listening to it at home. So I knew patterns of that music style already before picking up the instrument, and that helped me to get right into the process of playing and adapting it very quickly as a kid, because you absorb things without filter. You don't think, it's a game. And then you're 20 years old, you're 20 years of age, and you're like, wow, this is something I'm absolutely in. And then I went to Spain, and I could communicate immediately with all these people, so there was never a boundary.
Okay. It reminds me a little bit of when you're, eventually you if you become a writer, or from the point of view of somebody that writes, that before you've been reading for a long time, and it's almost like by the time you get to write, all these ideas, all these things that you've been reading come to life, and suddenly you realize you have a lot more vocabulary or ways of expressing things that you thought you did. I was interested in this aspect because both of you, both Snowowl and yourself, have you've spoken about how the music is originally, for example, in his case, well, prompted by his nation, and in your case, this community of outcasts, as you described it. So what do you think the power of music is to be able to go from that small community that is very isolated, you know, outside society in a way, in both cases, to actually becoming a, you know, an international thing where a lot of people can engage with that?
A very interesting friend of mine once said, you know, composing something and putting it out there is like throwing a stone into a sea. It will make circles, and it will touch all shores. And that's, for me, that's the beauty of it. Whenever I play a note, I know it will touch everybody in a different way, but it makes me feel confident. I know everybody will be listening to it. And I don't try to understand too much on a theoretical level or rational level. I really, nowadays, try more to deliver my emotion, and then I really don't know what can happen. It's just like the stone, you know? But you have to throw it. It's your duty, it's your responsibility within the chain of musicians, within history and everything that you've been transmitted by elder people and your masters. And one of my important flamenco maestros, Pepe Justicia, I was studying with him 3 times a week for many years, and it was very intense. And I used to live also at his house, and I met with his family and things like that in south of Spain. And one day he said, you know, everything you learn here, you will forget. And I was like, no, I didn't understand that concept, because I went specifically to him to learn his music, and I practiced his tunes, and I practiced everything he showed me. And eventually, years later, now I don't remember how to play his tunes, and I had played them, like, I knew them by heart, but they come out in a different way whenever you compose your own music. And nowadays it's nice because we have that very nice relationship where he can listen to a song of mine. Oh, that reminds me, not because of the melody, but because of the concept of composing behind that piece, that you have absorbed things of what I showed you.
Okay.
So it's all about a transformation.
Okay, so in that case, I suppose you also feel like a channel for that transformation. So perhaps like you are someone in the middle of that evolution, and you're just sort of like helping pass it on and keep continuing.
Yeah, I think you always should have that humble kind of attitude towards yourself, the instrument, and the audience, because these three elements I think are very important, and without one of them, kind of, it wouldn't make sense. You know, people say, well, I just play at home for me, but deep inside they would love to show it to somebody, you know. And I think it's important.
Is that right?
So it's important to, if you create something, share it. Because eventually it will make enlighten somebody, or somebody will learn from it, or inspire him to go on a hike, I don't know, whatever, right? So this is an important aspect, I think.
Do you think nowadays, with things like podcasts or very much globalized technology that has multiplied so much in comparison to previous times, the possibilities of being, of touching people, and because obviously that's the main idea, that's what you're aiming for, but the channels now are so much wider, and it's possible to touch more people. Just with that one stone, you can create far more ways than you could before.
Yeah, one post gets like around the world, right? Yeah, it's an edgy thing, because you have to be really careful how you project. It's about your intention and how you project, because it will go around the world. If you say something inappropriate, it will go around the world. If you say something very positive, it goes around the world. So the channels and the infrastructure is there for any kind of information. So it's about your ethic approach, and then it comes again, like what you think you are as a human being, and it might not necessarily be attached to what your education has been.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because they tell you all these things that you are and that you should be and that you should project in your life, and then it comes to a point where you said, no, this is me, and I'm taking this path. Mm-hmm. And it's a risk, but you eventually grow into that, and then you start taking responsibilities. And I think this is something important for young kids nowadays, whatever they want to choose, becoming musicians, scientists or whatever, it's a responsibility. It's not just doing it, because everybody can do anything, but doing it in a nice way that really has a meaning for the person who's doing it and for somebody else receiving it, that's when the circle of life, I think, fulfills itself. Yeah.
Well, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Okay, so I just wanted to finish. It's a bit more of a frivolous question. You have to forgive me. But I was just wondering about your nails, because I noticed that you've got some really beautiful nails, very looked after. I was just wondering, like, whether you really have
they're,
to.
They're all fake, so yeah, I think it's that, you know. No, I have my nails.
For
but
the
when
purposes
I,
of the guitar, I was wondering.
I have my, I have natural nails, but when I play so much, I put a coat sometimes on the tips,
right,
so they don't get too.
Brittle,
you know, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Billy.
But yeah, you always have to. You're always working on your nails. One tenth of a millimeter difference changes your whole thing.
Changes
and
the sound.
And it's really crazy with like the guitar thing.
Mm-hmm.
It, of course, every instrument has a big tough challenge, of course, but there's something that is you're sitting backstage, you're doing your runs, your scales.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go next to the stage, you're doing your run, your scales, and then you go on stage and nothing works, nothing is the same, and you go like, how come? And if you don't learn with the years to overcome this difficulty, it's literally like 5 minutes before everything was perfect.
Wow.
And then you go there and you do your intro in Mission Impossible, you say, why is my fingers not responding, like 2 minutes before? And this is something very, you have to work on it, you know.
And it could
even
be too
Paco de Lucia
yeah.
Paco de Lucia said that always, is like, how comes, you know, backstage you go and you go on stage and you think the first minutes you think nothing is working, you know? So it's like climbing a mountain. You start and eventually you get there, and then finally you see the view and you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's your duty to get there.
You have to get there first. Okay. Well, thank you so much. That was wonderful.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So Gavin, you are both a conductor and a composer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we are translators, and sometimes we write as well. So there's a broad similarity between moving from one field to the other, for example. What's it like? And I'm sure you've answered this before. We'll move on to more interesting questions after this. But from being a conductor to a composer, for us, it's we feel like what we... Well, not own, but that we are creatively involved even in the things that we translate. We're giving some kind of voice to them, which I'm sure you feel when you're conducting as well.
Yes.
But what's the biggest difference for you between those two disciplines?
The first thing to note is that I'm an accidental conductor. I did not set out to be a conductor. When I went to music college, I studied piano and composition. And I thought at the time, if I was to have a job in the classical field, it would maybe be conducting singers or soloists, but I really thought I would be a composer mostly. And it wasn't until I went to LA and started working with Hans Zimmer, where he essentially threw me into the studio and said, "You're conducting this movie," and I started doing it for real. Until that point, I'd been in front of an orchestra maybe twice in my life, to start with, I have to admit, I was not very good because I didn't really know how to communicate. You talked earlier about the conduit, and the thing about the conductor is if you do it right, you act as this conduit between the composer and the musicians. And the benefit of being a composer myself is that I can think like a composer, but also I think like a musician.
Okay.
So I see the technical difficulties the musicians might be having, and I'm right in front of them, and I also hear what the composer would like to happen. So I see my job is sort of a facilitator in that respect, for the music, for the composer, which is informed by my knowledge of composition. So I know when I started out, I was hopeless. I had no technique, and over the last 20 years, I've taken lessons, and also the School of Hard Knocks. You know, you try something with an orchestra, it doesn't work, so you try something else. You make some shapes and try and find some means of communicating it. And it's very... the feedback is instant.
Okay.
But what I realised just recently, I went on a week-long course with a very, very good conducting teacher from the Royal College, and we discovered... that musicians are not actually taught how to follow a conductor. It's just assumed. There's never any lessons as to what any of the conventions mean. There's a convention where when you're in 4-4 that the second beat goes to the left from the conductor's point of view.
Okay.
Obviously the right from the player. And in 3-4 you go to the right from the conductor's point of view. And even some professional players we spoke to hadn't actually realised that was the case, and it's not their fault. They've never been told it. So there's an element of education that actually needs to go on to understand the role of a conductor, because conductors are generally thought of as pretty pointless.
And you also mentioned as well in the arena tours that you do with Hans Zimmer, you have to really exaggerate your movements and everything.
I do that for two reasons.
Yeah.
One is that the orchestra is spread out over a huge area, and often the sight lines are not very good.
Yeah.
So they can't see, and there might be equipment in the way, or the way the stage is laid out is not ideal for the music. The other thing is for the audience. You know, we're in a 10,000 seater arena, and if you look in the distance, we're a little speck. And I think one of the things you can do as a conductor in a live situation is to help the audience to understand the music. Obviously I can't make any sound, but I can point out where the music's going in a way that can help you to be ready for it when it comes.
Yeah.
So I always try and match my movements to the size of the space. Obviously in the studio you hardly appear to be moving a lot of the time, but in the arena, big exaggerated movements, hopefully saying, okay, this is going to get big, or this is going, there's a trajectory on this phrase and it's going over this way, and stay with it, stay with it, then it lands. I don't know if it makes any difference. And that's the thing as a conductor, you never know if it makes any difference or not until it goes wrong.
Oh, of course. But you must be doing a fantastic job. All of you are, because Hans Zimmer is like one of the biggest shows in town.
It's amazing. I mean, this is the third time out for us.
Yeah.
And we had a rehearsal just before we went out again for this third time. And somehow it just locked in a way that it hadn't before, much more quickly. And it's like everyone had understood the overall form of the show, and we knew it, and it was within us. And I think audiences are responding to that.
Okay.
It's quite subtle, but it's definitely there.
It's like this intangible that you feel. Yeah.
So much for me of music is intangible, and that the I must admit I don't have the confidence that some of my other band members have in my ability to get to the music, because it is always so intangible to me, and I'll write a piece of music and I'll still not know if it's any good. I just, you know, I'll flip flop from one way to thinking this is fantastic. I'm a charlatan. I'm hopeless. You know,
it's the artistic curse, I think.
It is. Yeah. You know? And I've suffered from it probably more than most.
I drive her mad with it.
One of the things that I think actually did mess me up a little bit was going to music college, because on the one hand I got a fantastic piano technique and I understood a lot about composition, but I also realised that the music I was writing was totally out of step with the academic tradition. And at the time, because my father was a pop writer, and you know, you mentioned pop songs in a conservatoire and they laughed. I think it's changed now, actually, quite a lot. But at the time, it was very off-putting, because I thought, well, okay, that's not real music. Well, if this is real music, I don't really want to do it in terms of my creative output. Where does that leave me? So it's taken me 20 years to sort of come around to realising that what I do have to say is worth saying.
Okay. And you've also worked with an impressive range of people, the BBC, Everton Football Club, and with not the BBC, sorry, but the Jubilee, you're right, for the Queen's Jubilee, and all these institutions. So my question is generally, I mean, music is so present and so there in our culture, but also in the background. So it's kind of this dichotomy, this contradiction. So do you think the wider society has an appreciation, or maybe an acknowledgement that this classical musical tradition is there in all these big moments, or is it just background noise to a lot of people? Do you think?
Yeah, it's a big question. I'll answer it in parts. First is, a friend of mine went to the show in Birmingham, and he said it was the first concert he's ever been to. He couldn't believe the sounds of the woodwinds, of the strings and the brass, and he was introduced to this, and I thought, well, that's a tragedy, really, that it's the, you know, someone who, you know, he obviously was receptive to it, he enjoyed the concert, but he'd never been to it. So maybe, particularly in the UK, less so maybe in Europe, we have this idea that classical music is an elite thing that you have to study to understand. You don't. You just go along to the concert. If you like it, you like it. If it affects you, if it moves you, it moves you. And people are open to that. But I think the second part is we've become fragmented, and that people now listen to their music on their what are they called now? Not iPods, but on their phones. iPods, that's last century, isn't it? sorry, my age. It's an individual thing. You put your headphones on and listen to music individually. That is not the function of music. I always go back to thinking, you know, what were the first musicians? What was the first... And of course it would have been, you know, to use a sort of stock phrase, it would have been round the fire. People, community.
Yeah.
Making stories, making music, interacting together, creating together, and consuming the music together, not as consumers, but as you know, experiencing it. And now it is very much, oh, I consume music, I listen to rock music, or I listen to rap music, that's the thing I listen to by myself. See, it's causing the sirens to go. It's a big thing.
And you've in effect kind of done that as well. No, it brought it back into the communal space, because you've conducted movie scores with the scenes of the movies, and you brought people out of dark of the cinema, which is an individualistic way of consuming the content.
That's the amazing thing. When we did Interstellar at the Albert Hall, at the end of one scene, the audience just erupted into applause in the middle of a movie. Because they were so amazed at this thing that they just witnessed.
Yeah.
Yes, we're making the connection. Yeah, we kind of lost sometimes that it's also removed from the creative process of the music to the point where it enters your ear. And that's a problem. And I think, as Juan was saying earlier, you know, we need to really get back to that spiritual place of music and telling stories and community. And it does it so well.
Because especially, you mentioned Interstellar, which is a movie that should be communal in a way, because it's about humanity exploring new territories and new worlds. And also, you've conducted the Casino Royale theme as well.
Yes, done it a few times.
That's another kind of archetype that goes back to the fireside as well of the story. And when it comes to broader culture, every time there's a new Bond, like first with Pierce Brosnan perhaps, and then with Daniel Craig, society always asks, who is Bond in today's world? What do you think of that as someone who's been kind of involved with that world as well?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And I think for me, and this is probably sacrilegious to a lot of people, Bond now is actually a period piece, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think it's relevant in the modern world. I think that sort of person is not... It doesn't work anymore in the way that it did in the 60s, 70s. Daniel Craig's fantastic Bond. When you think about the sort of heroes we have now, the more like anti-heroes like Jason Bourne or some of those more complex characters.
Yeah.
I think Bond is from another era. So maybe it's reached the end of the road.
Okay,
that's what I think.
Would you have been interested to see director Danny Boyle's version of James Bond?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Anything he does, I'd be interested to see.
It's a really pity that he's walked away from that.
Well, maybe that's a sign that it's very hard to make those elements which you have to have.
Yeah.
Really, sort of fly in the world we're in now. It's from an earlier time, I think.
And also, I've seen in other interviews, you mentioned, for example, that North by Night, Northwest is your favourite score.
Oh, yeah.
It is absolutely gorgeous.
It's brilliant.
And as someone who's been involved in the business, how have you seen the change in music movie soundtracks? I mean, are they used differently in modern movies in the way that they weren't?
They tend to be. There's one of the things we suffer from, certainly from the Hollywood side, is the curse of the sequel. And the brilliant thing for the financiers about a sequel is it's probably going to make a good amount of money because you've flown the concept, everyone likes the concept, let's do it again. And of course what that leads to is a homogenizing of sound and look and everything. So those scores are in very tight parameters. Coupled with the fact that directors... And this may come in again to education, where people have not seen orchestras or heard orchestras or heard more complex music. They move away from melody and harmony, and so you end up with scores not through any fault of the composers that tend to be more drone based.
Yeah.
Say less melodic, and I miss that. Now there's plenty of melodic writers certainly in Europe and other parts of the world. Who buck that trend, so that's by no means the way it's all going, and that's the brilliant thing. Now you can make a film on an iPhone,
you can
record a score in a room, you don't need to have a super huge budget to do it, and that has opened up a lot of creativity, which I think is great. It's sort of leveled the playing field again.
And you've also mentioned that your favourite movie is Chinatown. Is that still true?
Yes, it is still true. Yeah. I haven't seen it for a long time, and every time I watch it, I'm shocked by it. The twists and turns, and another great score, actually, Jerry Goldsmith's score.
Everything involved with it is amazing.
Yeah.
And would you like more of an opportunity to work on those kind of film noir, kind of heavier movies?
Yeah, I don't know. Are they being made still?
I don't think so. No, it starts here.
Now, is that because I was growing up at that time, and the things that you experience in your late teens seem to have a disproportionate effect on your musical taste or in your film taste, maybe for the rest of your life. Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
It feels like The Conversation. Do you know that?
With Gene Hackman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love all those films. They're, by modern standards, they're very slow and
yeah.
maybe not much happens, but you can... Obviously, I've just realised that you have to go into them and they draw you in.
And it reflects the kind of Cold War paranoia of the time as well.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say about Woven? Which, as we've mentioned, is... absolutely fantastic, by the way.
It does all tie in with what
yeah.
we've been talking about in
yeah.
terms of telling stories. And I went back to a format which was the vinyl LP and said, why does a CD have to be 70 minutes, 75 minutes? You can put that amount of time on a CD, but you don't have to. And I thought back to the LP where you were pushing it at 45 minutes. So I designed the album so that it, although obviously it's on streaming and CD as well as vinyl, each side is about 22 minutes. And I use that the flip in the middle to have an event happen that you don't know what the event is, but something happens in between turning sides. So the story has a turn in it that it's sort of entirely up to you to decide what happens.
Okay.
I haven't written that part, but it's there. And then I carry on. So, the idea of telling a story with some parameters that maybe again hark back to my teenage years. I feel like I've been psychoanalyzed. very cleverly, but I've just spilled the beans.
that's why there's a sofa here. fantastic stuff. Thank you so much.
I didn't want to say that.
Part three of the show. I hope you enjoyed those interviews with the fantastic cultural gentlemen that form parts of Hans Zimmer's world tour. Juan Garcia Herreros, who also goes by the name Snow Owl, Gavin Greenaway, and El Amir. So you can find us, El Arpa, on Instagram with El Arpa, Twitter, El Arpa 1, YouTube, and our blog, Irish Slice of Madrid. And if you listen to us on Radio Public, you can help with our finances, but also you can listen to us on any podcast platform. Thank you very much. The El Arpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.